I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Candidate Barack Obama built a grassroots movement using social media that helped him win the White House in 2008. Now other political campaigns are using Twitter and Facebook to get out their messages, to organize supporters, respond to news events, and challenge their opponents. Take the recent brouhaha about Ann Romney and working moms that played out on Twitter. Well, today in Radio Times, we want to explore the increasing influence of social media and on politics and campaigns. And we have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Daniel Seberg. He's a spokesperson for the Google Politics and Elections team, a former TV network and cable news correspondent. And Daniel Seberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And on the telephone is Andrew Riché. He's the founder of Personal Democracy Forum and co-founder of Tech President. He has worked with a number of Democratic political leaders and government officials. In fact, during the 2004 presidential campaign, then presidential candidate Howard Dean named him chairman of the Technology Advisory Committee. And Andrew Riché, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
I'd love to be here. Thank you very much.
And Andrew, let me begin with you. You wrote a piece that was published recently in the Philadelphia Inquirer about the use of social media during the Arab Spring. Are we experiencing a similar phenomenon in the U.S.?
Absolutely. I mean, when you say a similar phenomenon, the Arab Spring obviously is it's a broad term that has a lot to do with more than social media. It has to do with politics and big changes in the political environment in the Mideast. So what I'm trying to do a correlation to is the fact that as these technologies continue to advance, as more and more people around the world are getting connected, as the ways of using social media to engage in political discourse are becoming more and more prevalent, it's very clear that a new emerging class of global citizens is emerging, what I like to call an internet public, that is using networks to challenge authorities, using networks to challenge hierarchies, and is struggling to build a new way forward in the 21st century politically, economically, and socially.
Just picking up on that, and then I do want to get to Daniel in on the conversation, but I'm thinking about all the money that super PACs have spent and even campaigns have spent on things like TV and radio ads. I mean, millions and millions of dollars during this GOP primary season. Do you see this as another battleground that's using social media?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a weapon that is going to be used by political candidates, political parties, and advocacy groups, and obviously super PACs to influence the discourse that goes on around elections. But social media also offers citizens a much more robust opportunity to engage with each other. I mean, if you think about it, politics has always allowed people to engage with each other. They still do it, actually, around the most common places like dining room tables or water coolers at the office, and they share their opinions of political candidates and political issues, and eventually a consensus is formed. But now with social media, many of those conversations are, in fact, on steroids. Yeah, even my 85-year-old dad is sending friends Barack Obama YouTube videos, which in a previous election, you know, before social media, before he even knew how to use email, it would have taken him 20, to reach 20 people, it would have taken them 3 or 4 months to wait to see them at some event or some dinner. So it's a new tool. It's going to be used extensively by the political candidates and the campaigns and the super PACs. But it's starting to point to the fact that the citizens can now fight back. It's asking for more discourse, more participation, more validation, and in some cases it makes things worse because it sometimes becomes an echo chamber. But
right.
It offers an opportunity for more citizen engagement.
And I want to pick up on some of those things. Let me get you in on the conversation. And Daniel, you have worked in TV, both cable and network, and now you're I guess, on the other side. I don't know if you think that way. But from your perspective, do you see some pretty dramatic changes going on?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been involved with some form of technology and politics for many years, watching how people engage with each other. And I think that's what we're really talking about. How do people feel like they're legitimately and contributing in a sense that's meaningful to them? So, You know, it used to be a little abstract to say that you were involved in a political campaign. What did that mean exactly? Were you at a rally? Did you talk to somebody about an issue? Did you call into a radio show? You know, today you can post something, you can see something tangible, you can post a video, you can post a tweet or something on Google Plus and see that sort of interaction and engagement with people. It's much more, I think it feels much more real. But to Andrew's point, you know, it can turn into that echo chamber. And beyond that, to people, it can feel a little overwhelming. You know, there's a lot of noise, let's say, that you sort of have to filter through to get to perhaps the like-minded people that you're interested in. Of course, the great thing about that is there are a lot of choice, and you can find those people with a little bit of work.
You talked about rallies, which took me back to the 1960s and the anti-war rallies that I attended. But do you I just dated myself there. But do you see this as a replacement for those kinds of movements where people take to the streets? Occupy is a good example of that. I think that use both media and also a physical presence to make a point.
I think they complement each other, you know. So we see people still gathering in large numbers, and there's something to that sense of community and seeing other people who believe in what you do. But I think the big rise that's really contributing to that is the smartphone. So today, it's not just that you're sitting in front of your computer. You think back to 2008, 2004 with other big presidential campaigns. A lot of people were consuming this and digesting this information sitting in front of a laptop or a computer. Smartphones are becoming increasingly ubiquitous. It allows you to communicate while you're on the go. You mentioned the Arab Spring. A lot of how people were interacting was through their device. Now, there are different degrees of how smart a smartphone is, and not everybody has the same kind of access. But I think that increasingly that is where people are getting their information, and social media is seeing that as a big battleground.
Andrew, going back to you, when we talk about social media, are we largely talking about Twitter and Facebook?
No, I mean, we're talking about the entire network. I mean, there's all kinds of tools out there. I mean, obviously, Twitter and Facebook are the most, you know, common references related to social media, but even Instagram is a social media platform. Google Plus is a fantastic tool that allows people to connect with each other and to have conversations with each other, sometimes in real time. So there's a whole toolbox of social media tools. I wanted to pick up though a little bit and build on what Daniel was saying.
Sure.
Related to the Arab Spring, because one of the, you know, it's true that everybody's, you know, more and more people are having, you know, smartphones or having these devices, but one of the key elements around the Arab Spring was that many of the young people there and many of the people organizing the protests knew that if they were able to get their messages out on the internet, it would leap the borders and international pressure would be brought on the regime. That points to the fact that people are aware of the global implications of these technologies. It's not just local. And yes, Occupy Wall Street has used some of these tools, and to some degree frustrating, existing leaders, because they can't find the, it's not a leaderless movement, it's a leader full movement, but there's no single person or entity to either attack or anoint. And these are examples of these kind of networks that spring up, whether it's the public outcry over the cutting of funding to Planned Parenthood by Susan B. Komen, or the more recent example of the Kony video on YouTube. Almost anyone who has a constituency online can create an instant political advocacy group using social media tools.
Daniel, you wrote a book about going on a digital diet. I mean, you wear several interesting hats. One is that you're part of this Google politics, but you've also sensed that or felt that, experienced that sense of overload.
Mm-hmm. And you've noticed my smartphone is safely tucked away.
It is,
now.
Although I have to say, Andrew, I hear little pings coming from you, so you're clearly not entirely unplugged. But go ahead, Daniel.
Well, you know, so there, I don't see it as a contradiction at all. I think that people at any company or in any profession feel slightly overwhelmed today by the amount of information that's out there, how you consume it. And so, you know, from my book's perspective, it's just about thinking about moderation. Of course, everything in moderation, including moderation, but, you know, that long-term strategy with how you consume all of this data that's coming at us, it really can be like trying to sip from a fire hose. That is, I think, true of political information that's out there, too. There is so much of it, and hopefully, you know, people are soon able to find the right tools for them that work. And so I guess that's where the book ties in, is that, you know, feeling ownership over that data and that information rather than feeling bombarded by it.
So where do you get, I mean, how do you then get your, when you wake up in the morning, where and how do you get your information?
It's a mix of places. I try to tailor my streams or my filters so that I get what I want. You know, I don't necessarily follow as many people on Twitter as some other people might, so that I can try to parse that information a little bit easier. I set up different circles within Google Plus. I try to have different pages and bookmarks that I go to. Of course, there's email. I mean, you could spend hours and hours and hours trying to get through some of this stuff. So it does take a little bit of investment in time to kind of tailor it and manage it. But hopefully that saves you time down the road.
How about for you, Andrew?
Well, you know, I couldn't help, as Daniel was talking about, saying what he tailors his media consumption to stuff that he likes. There's a well-known book that recently came out, written by Eli Pariser, called The Filter Bubble, which asks the question about whether or not we're creating echo chambers for ourselves, and that we're not actually listening to what the other side is saying, and we're only sort of getting fed what we want or what we think we want. And it's a very pertinent question to the way in which these technologies are moving so fast that we're not really thinking about some of the consequences associated with their ease of use and what they're offering us.
I would say too that some of the services and technologies almost think for you. In other words, you may not be manually tailoring the information that's coming in, but they start to learn your preferences and who you want to follow and what things are important to you, and so that shifts. So I would agree with Andrew that there is a danger or a trap of falling into when you're missing out on certain perspectives and things. But I think that that's true of analog information too. You know, you pick up the newspapers you want to read, you read the books that you want to. You know, you don't always get exposed to the other side of things, but I would absolutely agree that it's worth experimenting and seeing what's out there.
You want to add to that, Andrew? I have to say, Eli Pariser was on the show.
I do think that it would be fantastic if Congress or the next generation of Congress, if we can get them elected fast enough, takes up the issue of public media in the 21st century. We had, obviously public television, public radio, sort of born out of a concern for a neutral public square of discourse, and I'm not quite sure that we've figured out how to do that in the 21st century yet.
We're about a minute away from our first break here, but Andrew, just picking up on that, what would that look like then? The kind of public media that you're talking about?
Well, maybe a benign search engine that doesn't actually track your preferences. In fact, I think Sergey Brin and Larry Page in an early paper at Stanford before they even thought of Google, wrote something about the fact that they thought that a search engine would have to be built that would avoid being co-opted by advertising. Little did they know that they were going to actually move down that path themselves much later. But there needs to be some place where we can create the town square where you can, we can actually hear opposing voices to your own. If you have a community board hearing, or if you have a city council hearing somewhere, you don't always hear what you want, and you don't always hear your own opinion reflected back at you. So we haven't built those tools. And the other thing is we don't actually have a public internet. It's really a private internet controlled by multinational corporations with responsibilities to shareholders, with varying degrees of terms of service that aren't transparent and aren't easy to understand. And many of the lawyers who wrote those terms of service were educated in the 20th century.
Hold on to that thought, only because they're playing my song. That means we have to take
it. I hear it now.
You go. We have to take a very short break. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Supporting WHYY 7th Generation, celebrating Earth Day every day with eco-friendly solutions ranging from dish liquid to detergent to diapers. More at 7thGeneration.com. Caring today for 7 generations of tomorrows.
Delaware Rep supports WHYY and presents Thornton Wilder's Pulitzer Prize-winning comedy, The Skin of Our Teeth, now through May 5th. Called a marriage of Plato and Groucho Marx, the Antrobus family faces one disaster after another. From woolly mammoths to Atlantic City showgirls and end-of-the-world warfare, only to endure and thrive in this timeless tale of human inspiration and survival. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or rep.udel.edu.
WHYY-FM. You listen, you enjoy. and you know you're going to make a donation. So why not just do it now? And if you do, you can enjoy YStream, our regular WHYY FM programming delivered online without membership breaks. Sign up for YStream by April 22nd. For more information and to make your donation now, visit whyy.org/YStream.
Supporting WHYY Bosch Thermo Technology, manufacturer of geothermal heat pumps that use the constant temperature of the earth to heat and cool homes. More information at boschgeo.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about or looking to answers for this question, how are political campaigns taking advantage of our interest in and love of and obsession with digital technology and social media, and how is that changing politics? Our guests who are Andrew Riché, joining us by telephone, founder of Personal Democracy Forum and co-founder of Tech President. Also with us is Daniel Seberg. He's a spokesperson for the Google Politics and Elections team, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Daniel, let me just pick up on what Andrew was saying right before the break about creating this town square free of advertising, you know, free of the kind of outside influence that obviously concerns him.
Yeah, I think.
Can we create that?
Well, I can see why that's important to people, and we have seen that politicians have latched onto, in Google's case, some unique examples of that. And I would point to Hangouts that are part of Google Plus. I don't want to turn this into an ad for Google.
Me neither.
But we've seen Mitt Romney do a Hangout on air with some of his supporters. President Obama did one not too long ago. Even at a local level, the Wisconsin Democratic Party had a Hangout, which is this 10-person video chat that happens over Google Plus, and you can bring people in and have a discussion. Now, I know that that's not perfect, and it may be not quite what Andrew's talking about, but it does tend to break down the barriers a little bit, and the people who can participate and submit their questions feel a little bit more participatory in the process, and it doesn't feel quite so distant from them. At least that's a reaction that we've been getting from people.
But Andrew, seems to me that once you get campaigns involved, that they're largely running the show. No? Yes?
Yeah, well, I mean, campaigns' jobs are not to make a better democracy. Campaigns' job is to get their candidate elected.
Exactly.
They're two different things, and Daniel's description of the tool is an accurate one. It's a good tool to allow engagement. It allows more granularity. It allows authenticity to be shared. But you know, there's fundamental structural problems in our democracy which you know aren't being addressed. You know, we've been choking our education system for 30 years. We don't teach civics in public schools. We don't even elect our elected leaders. With gerrymandering and the way they control districting, they actually choose us. Why do we only vote on Tuesdays as opposed to on a weekend or over a week? And there's far too much money in politics. So our political system has been mutated, and the technology is advancing and offering some new opportunities for engagement. That's true, but we're not asking ourselves some bigger structural questions about how do you build a 21st century democracy, not just in the United States, but on a global level, where soon we're going to have 6 or 7 billion people connected on devices that are going to make our iPhones and Android phones look like Motorola briefcase phones from 10 years ago. Everything's changing, and that means that we have to not only wait for the institutions to be formed, but we have to be asking ourselves tough questions about the relationship between big data and how it's being collected, who owns it, who controls it, and our own addiction to these tools, which we click on apps, we click on websites, we sign the terms of service, we never read them. We need to be asking ourselves some very fundamental questions about how to create a fabric of society in the 21st century that goes beyond the usual political discourse that you're seeing in this election cycle.
Daniel, let me pick up on big data, the idea of data mining, literally. And if we're talking about political campaigns, what campaigns know about us? I mean, while we might be watching them, they're watching us.
Of course. I mean, I think that it's not too shocking for folks to know that political campaigns want and need that information. It may make some people uncomfortable. You know, how much of this is being shared? Where is it being shared? Where are they getting it from? What do they want to know exactly? But certainly, I think that's a pretty big shift over the last 4 or 8 years, especially in terms of what political campaigns are after and how they use it. That said, you know, how they use it, how effective it is, what does it actually lead to? You know, there's a lot of onus on those campaigns to try to really find those nuggets of data, the right people to target, how to get them that information. It's not perfect by any means, and I'm not here to defend what any of the campaigns are doing with that information, but it's certainly something that they're interested in, and they make no secret of the fact that they are trying to find the right constituents to share their messages with.
And the idea is micro-targeting, which is finding out something about me or you, and then targeting a campaign ad or a message somehow to individuals.
Sure, it could be down to the person's zip code. I mean, this is really the 21st century equivalent of going and knocking on doors. Of course, this is different. It's faster. They can do this in bulk. You know, how meaningful is it for people? Does it really make that much difference? I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know that they get a lot of mileage out of this sort of thing. That I don't think that's going to stop them from doing it in any way, but they certainly are going at it.
Go ahead, Andrew.
There's a whole series of tactics. I mean, you know, Barack Obama is sending, actually, his campaign is sending almost an email every single day to its supporters, but it's coming from a different person so that it doesn't quite come across as spam. You know, you get one from Michelle Obama one day, one from David Plouffe another, and you should assume that both campaigns are collecting not only voter file information. They know whether you've signed up to give $3, whether you gave in the last campaign. They know whether you visit their website, whether you're signed on to their social media platforms. They see whether you tweet. But they also will use publicly available data where they can collect it the same as any Fortune 500 company does and figure out whether or not you're buying environmental products at the grocery store or whether you might be interested in education issues. And then they'll start targeting, and they'll know whether you voted in the last primary or not, and they'll start targeting you specifically based on, you know, what they know. They'll do it differently depending upon also whether it's a state that's in play for the Electoral College or whether, for example, in New York, which is a state they need to raise a lot of money from in order to fund their outreach in the states where Electoral College might matter. Both campaigns are going to do this. The only advantage I would say that the Obama campaign has is that they have a much longer runway. The data gets better and better over time, and they've been doing this much, much longer than the Romney campaign has been able to do, so they'll have to play catch-up. But we should all assume that the same big data strategies that are used by Fortune 500 companies are now front and center inside the political operations of these campaigns.
I would just add that I think that increasingly, anecdotally, you know, I see people becoming savvier about this kind of approach from not just from campaigns but from advertisers. And so when they see all of this kind of targeted advertising or campaigning going on, you know, I think their filters are going up, not necessarily their technological filters, but their antenna are up. They see this potentially as something they don't want to pay any attention to. I think there's a danger of overdoing it because I think you can really turn people off if you do it too much, not just that they're worried about what data is being shared and when and how, but the fact that if you overwhelm them with this stuff, it's going to create the opposite effect and you're going to annoy a lot of these people.
Yeah,
do you agree with that, Andrew?
I agree with that, and I actually want to make an observation, which you know, the Obama campaign has a real challenge with, which is because the 2008 campaign was really the operative word in that campaign was "we," and "we" is a sort of subconsciously sort of an elixir inside social media. It sort of plays well online. There was an authenticity around the "we," but this campaign, his campaign is much more about "I" than "we," and he's going to have a hard time trying to convince the public that he's leading a movement towards a new democracy. He's really just trying to convince people that he's the best guy to go forward.
Well, and even just to compare the kind of, as you say, micro-targeting that's going on, whether it works or not, I guess only time will tell. But I'm also comparing that to the kinds of ads that we have seen on TV, on the radio, that, I mean, talk about a big hose. I mean, they tend to be negative. They tend to, make assumptions about the people that are watching TV at that time. And Daniel, I guess I'm looking at you since you spent some time in TV. I've never known whether, you know, TV or radio ads work to persuade people one way or the other. Is there any way to know whether this kind of targeting is any more effective?
Well, and we certainly haven't seen TV ads stopping or even slowing down. It feels like there are more and more of them. A lot of them end up on YouTube and other video channels as well.
And they get talked about on the media as well.
Sure, of course. So I think that, you know, but I will say that the, you know, when we're talking about this sort of targeted approach to voters, you know, it's not impossible to measure the amount of return that you're getting on this, but I think it can be a little squishy. I think that there are the equivalents of snake oil salespeople out there offering to be experts on how social media is affecting a particular campaign or not, showing different numbers and, you know, how this may or may not translate into votes. But I think that that doesn't stop political campaigns from trying to reach out from this. They feel like they're doing these sort of land grabs. They're just reaching out to virtually every social network that pops up and seeing what works. And their approach, it seems to me, and Andrew could maybe disagree with me here, but they seem to sort of just go after as many people as possible with as many outlets as possible and just hope that it sticks.
And see what works. Go ahead, Andrew.
At the risk of being labeled a snake oil salesman, I will say that that social media does offer something, which is the opportunity to build community, and the byproduct of community is money. So if you can build community and give citizens tools that make them feel like they're involved, that they can organize, that they can talk back, that they can participate in some way, their likelihood of giving money is greater, and therefore that sort of feeds all the other elements of the campaign, whether it's get out the vote or the broadcast media advertising that you referred to at the beginning of this question. So it's an ecology, and it should be thought of as a political ecology, and it has different components, and there are different practitioners who do it better than others. But it's the days of, you know, television, you know, the mushroom cloud television advertising completely changing the direction of a campaign are probably over. On the other hand, mainstream media still is the ringmaster. Huh. We could be talking about Trayvon one minute, and then Hillary Rosen says something inappropriate, and then it takes over the airwaves. Or there's a Secret Service scandal in Colombia. The pace of this is often dictated now by mainstream media, but it then turns into social media quickly. And there is some give and take, because sometimes something happens in social media that jumps to mainstream media. It's not just one way. But like I mentioned, it's important to think of it as an ecology, and it's important to think about everyone's role and responsibilities in that ecology.
And that's Andrew Roche. He's the founder of Personal Democracy Forum, also co-founder of Tech President. Excuse me, and he joins us along with Daniel Seberg. He's a spokesperson with the Google Politics and Elections team. And we are talking today on the show about the influence of social media on politics and political campaigns. We're interested in how and where you get your news, besides, of course, National Public Radio and WHYY. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Daniel, before we get to our callers, though, just picking up on what Andrew just said, I mean, would you say, bottom line, if we're talking about political campaigns, the idea is to get people to vote for your candidate and also get them in the end to give money, that it is about money, because money is what drives our political campaigns.
Money is important to the political campaigns, and I think that, you know, for voters, you know, I think that, let's be realistic, there are a lot of voters out there who feel passionately about their candidate or their political beliefs, and no amount of social media information or television ads is going to change how they feel. I think that a lot of this is going after that sort of middle core, the independents who aren't sure. They're trying to track down some of this stuff. And so that I feel like that's where a lot of this is being targeted. Is it the coin of the realm today? Yes, I think that it has to be. It's a reality for these political campaigns. They will go after this frontier, and they are going after it full bore.
Let me get, looks like David from Center City, Philadelphia, to join our conversation. And excuse me, David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Just a quick response to that.
Sure.
Speaking of coin of the realm, I think it's also an issue for public broadcasting and other mission-driven entities to tap social media for campaigns. That's really a side point. I'd like to ask a question of the gentleman from...
Go ahead, David.
From Google?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So it's my understanding that Google has a division or a zone, might be google.org, which is where the company develops new tools with interaction with crowdsourcing and others to, in some cases, develop innovative tools, in some cases, with public benefit outcomes. Is that true?
Google.org is a part of Google, and it works a lot with different charitable organizations and nonprofits. There are parts of that, for example, the crisis response team, which is, gets involved whenever there's a major disaster somewhere and partners with different aid organizations. For example, what happened in Haiti, and some folks that were part of the crisis response team came up with this People Finder app to help track down loved ones. So yes, I mean, that is an entity within Google. Of course, Google's a very big place, and there are a lot of things going on, but that is one of them.
David, thanks for the call. Let's see what Gary from Malvern has to say. And Gary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
I guess I'm a contrarian because I'm a political independent.
Okay.
I'm 68 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
And yet, I think the political... I am sick of what's going on with the political process. I'm tired of robocalls. I'm tired of unsolicited email. I'm tired of all this thing trying to target me. On the other hand, I believe the Internet is a marvelous device to democratize activism. And I can give you good examples of the Trayvon Martin situation. Look at the power it was able to mobilize people again on this issue. Look at the pink slime situation with Hamburger. Again, I think it was a petition on change.org that got ABC aware of this issue.
Well,
they did an investigative report, and look what's happening today. The big companies, the big grocery stores are dropping it like flies. And
well, you know, Gary, hold on only because I want to give Andrew Richey a chance to weigh in on your comment. And I can relate to a lot of what Gary is saying there. Andrew, go ahead.
Well, I mean, he's correct. There's lots of examples. I mean, the outrage over the cutting of funding to Planned Parenthood by Susan G. Komen was probably the one that comes to mind first. But also the recent battle over copyright legislation in Congress, where the copyright industry overreached on two bills known as commonly known as SOPA and PIPA, and very quickly the internet community mobilized itself and pushed back bills that had in the Senate 41 sponsors, basically dropped the bills in a matter of days. What this is pointing to, and what I think we're all hopeful for, is that the internet offers an opportunity for there to be a new type of political currency. One that's not built on the influence of money in politics, although money still plays a role, but rather through the connections of people through networks. And people are starting to turn to each other. They're starting to use these tools, which are very common, inexpensive, and starting to become ubiquitous, and are starting to, in a laser beam, focus on certain issues that are important to them. However, it's still early, and so far in many of the cases, what we've been able to do is get people to organize themselves to say no to something. It's much harder to say yes to something and to build something. So we still have to take a further step, which is to use the internet in a way to build a better democracy that creates more discourse and fair discourse and a reasonable display of the facts rather than the hyperbole that we're currently seeing in the political system.
You know,
and
hold on to that thought,
okay.
Only because we have to take another short break, and I don't want to have to interrupt you. We are talking with Andrew Richey, the founder of Personal Democracy Forum and co-founder of Tech President. Also with us is Daniel Seberg. He's a spokesperson for the Google Politics and Elections team, and in fact, tonight they'll be part of a panel across the street here at the National Constitution Center, a panel titled Social Media, the New Political Battleground, and it begins at 6:30. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with organically tanned leather from Scotland, Prussian burl wood, French seams, and curve control. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
WHYY is supported by the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Van Gogh Up Close, paintings from Vincent Van Gogh's final years, when the artist developed radical new ways of capturing nature on canvas. The Philadelphia Museum of Art is the only U.S. venue for this exhibition, on view through May 6th only. Tickets for Van Gogh Up Close are available online at philamuseum.org or 215-235-SHOW.
Westtown School supports WHYY. Since 1799, Westtown has invited students pre-K through grade 12 to pursue a life-size education, one that helps to prepare each student for what comes next, not only for college and career, but for a whole life. You can learn more by attending Westtown's open house on Monday, April 23rd at 9 a.m. Details at westtown.edu. Westtown School, a life-size education.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the political race, the political campaigns that are playing out on Twitter and Facebook, YouTube, and other social media. As we know, President Obama used these tools very effectively in 2008. We're talking about how they are shaping election politics this year in 2012, talking with Daniel Seberg and Andrew Riche. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Daniel, I know you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on what Andrew was talking about with SOPA and PIPA, which was this proposed legislation that was trying to track down internet pirates. Very controversial. A lot of internet and tech companies, including Google, was rallying folks online. And as Andrew pointed out, this huge response and a great example of how people pulled together on a particular issue. And that is really speaking to the power of the internet. I will say just tangentially to what that gentleman asked about before, just how great this is, I think the concern, you know, having spent about 15 years working in news, is the misinformation that can get put out along with that. And so the push to be first, to try to get stuff out there, even attached to the Trayvon Martin case, we saw an example with NBC News when they had an edit to a particular 911 call that was shared all over the place. And I think, you know, of course, there are lots of other details to this case, and we don't know everything. But, you know, that kind of thing, that's a danger that happens with all of this, too.
And I guess that's noise versus signal, right, Andrew?
Well, yeah, and I actually, just reminds me to mention a book that just came out by Howard Rheingold, who's a famous author in the digital space called NetSmart, where he's basically encouraging us all to recognize that we have to become digitally literate, that we need to ask tough questions about what we're seeing online. We, you know, when at least for me, when I was growing up, I was told don't believe everything you read. Well, on the internet, it's even more so, and these tools really require a set of skills of understanding in order to know when snake oil in effect is being sold. And Daniel's right. There was hyperbole on both the copyright side and on the internet side related to the SOPA PIPA, and we're not asking ourselves the important questions about how do we get to the, you know, to the facts. Daniel Moynihan once said, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but they're right. Not entitled to their own set of facts, and it's very accurate and relates it to the internet.
And as part of that, Andrew, you have to consider the reliability of the source where the information comes from. But as you both have said, we're so, and I include myself in this, just flooded with information and trying to keep up with everything and figure out what is true and what isn't true.
Correct. And therefore, you know, we should be simultaneously, while we're marveling at the technology and marveling at the connectivity, we should be asking ourselves the questions about how do we maintain a sense of balance and mm-hmm. you know, make sure that there's a good result from this explosion of information. People sometimes say there's way too much information. The reality of it is, it's not too much information. There's just really bad filters.
Oh, interesting.
And we need to figure out better tools for filtering and understanding the information that's coming to us, rather than simply trying to shut it out or abusing it in some way.
Well, and picking up on something you said earlier, Daniel, I was thinking about this psychological condition, I guess, called confirmation bias, which is that you seek out the information that in a sense reinforces what you believe, so that you can then create these silos of people, all of whom believe the same thing and would never think of going to someone else's silo.
Yeah, it's all our sort of digital yes men that are out there to acknowledge everything that we're believing and what we think is true. And there is definitely a fear that a lot of people will fall into that huge echo chamber that can be created online. I think it speaks to everything that we're talking about, and that is that there is a lot of onus on us as the individual to be cognizant of this, to think about this, to be responsible, to not, and you know, people say, there's so much information, I feel overwhelmed. I don't want, you know, my hope is people don't just give up, because that is totally, I think, counter to the democratic process, to, you know, we're talking about politics and elections and how people consume information. You know, I worry that people are just going to kind of tune out and stop trying to find these things. And there are ways to do it easier, and I hope that people continue to push forward and think about that. But there is, at the end of the day, you know, it can be up to the individual.
And Andrew, there's a lot of snark out there as well. I mean, if you read a lot of sites and then you read, you know, blog posts and people responding to each other, it oftentimes devolves into something that's pretty boring and uninteresting.
Yeah, well, we live in an attention society, and so, you know, people resort to all kinds of tactics in order to draw attention to themselves and to draw the eyeballs and to draw the advertisers and to draw the income. That's why I'm saying that we need to have a national discussion, if not a global discussion, about how to create a space for public media in the 21st century.
Let me see what Marco from West Philadelphia has to say. Marco, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Thank you for having my call.
You're very welcome.
I was just wanting to comment on that. Can we really pick and choose when we will be targeted and when we will not? Because as you're saying, there's so much information out there that all of these targeted campaigns allow me to find the things that I'm interested in and so forth. And in the same way with political campaigns, if I'm a Democrat, I will see Democrat information. And so once we sort of remove the filters, and there's a huge inpouring of all the information that I need to make an informed decision, then won't I then just get information fatigue?
Get information fatigue, which is something that Daniel Seberg, you wrote about. So we're caught between all this wonderful information, trying to figure out how to navigate and pick through it and use it to help us stay informed.
And certainly I am not suggesting that it's easy to do. I think that there are ways to make it easier. There are technological ways, whether you're setting up your RSS feeds or picking particular websites or logging into different social media and trying to tailor how it comes into you. But again, I think it does go back to you and thinking about what's important to you and experimenting, seeing the sort of best sites or pundits or people who matter to you. The social side of things may also play into your friends and family, talking to them about what's important, mm-hmm. how they're getting their information. But, at the end of the day, it's up to us to be part of that process.
Andrew, you want to add to that?
As I mentioned earlier, I'd love to see a show of hands of your listeners right now. When was the last time they clicked on an app or clicked on a website and actually read the terms of service all the way through before they agreed? We are not asking ourselves the critical questions about what our responsibilities are to make this situation better, to make the technology work better, to hold companies accountable, to hold elected leaders accountable, and to hold ourselves accountable for making our democracy or our society work better.
Because what you're saying is that we are giving away information about ourselves all the time, whether we know it or not.
All the time.
Right.
And we don't recognize, we're not asking whether or not the value we get back is worth it.
Well, and I'm also thinking, and just picking up on that, in a very sort of technical question then, Andrew, how are, if we're talking about political campaigns, how do they know whether I voted? How do they know
Voter file information is available publicly.
How do they know what I buy? How do they know?
There are large public databases that are being collected all the time. When you sign up for your Stop and Shop card, Stop and Shop knows exactly what you've bought. Did you check to see whether or not Stop and Shop has told you that they're going to share that information with other retailers? Or, for example, when you tweet about an environmental issue that's important to you, or you tweet about an education issue that's important to you, you're publicly making a statement that may be scraped by a political campaign or a company that knows to target you with either an environmental message or an education message or something else. So the technology to collect this information is out there. The storage capacity and the ability to crank it and run the data through algorithms to deliver some information is also out there. What's not out there is a public knowledge of that, of the capabilities of these technologies, and a public accountability for either the political campaigns or the companies that are doing this for what they're sharing. And by the way, right now there is a bill running through Congress, several bills running through Congress related to cybersecurity that that a number of technology companies have signed on to that is giving what I call the Internet public some pause about companies sharing information with the government under the rubric of cybersecurity, but may, in fact, violate many of our civil rights as it relates to the Constitution. So this is, you know, there are forces at work trying to put the genie back in the bottle. Our democracy may suffer in the process. It's incumbent on everybody to pay attention.
But do you think, just picking up on that, Daniel, that because of the convenience that we get from social media, that we give away stuff stuff about ourselves without thinking clearly and deeply about it?
I mean, I think that's you sort of ask anybody, do you care about your privacy and care about your data online? I think that, you know, a lot of people might say yes. And I think that the reality is that an increasing number aren't as concerned, or maybe that's the perception that we're getting. You know, I think that I mean, Andrew's absolutely right that companies are taking this information and sharing it, and, you know, maybe we're not doing enough to be part of that process. But I also think that, you know, it is true. I talk to a lot of young folks, and they just don't seem to care about that stuff as much as we might either want them to or think they do. And, you know, I think that is the way that the world is shifting a little bit. I don't mean to suggest that that's right or wrong, but that's my observation, that I have seen a lot of folks feeling that way. I think it can make a lot of us uncomfortable, but that does seem to be the reality.
Do you think it's a generational thing, that we're talking about a generation that has grown up with this stuff, and so it's just so seamless in their lives?
I think it's partly a generational thing. I think there's also just a technological aspect to it, and the fact that, you know, the internet is just a seamless experience for people. There's not a finite log on and log off anymore. You know, we are constantly in the web or the internet. And so, you know, getting that perspective can be difficult because that information, you know, is so readily available.
Andrew, going back to you, and you've talked about this several times, the idea of creating a kind of public square, public digital square, I guess, where we're free from the kind of intrusions that we have been talking about. Do you see that as government responsibility to create that square, or should that be a more bottom-up call?
I think it's a combination. I think that it has to happen in a partnership between government or governance and citizens. And I'm not, you know, quite ready to be the architect for it, but today. But you know, it's very clear that our political system is manipulated to a large degree by special interests that use, as I mentioned earlier, the currency of money to influence how decisions are made. I personally believe that we're never going to pass campaign finance reform legislation in this country of any meaningful sort. But I do believe that we're going to start electing more and more people through the power of networks, using less and less money, and through the power of communities. So there is a grassroots opportunity, and we're seeing it around the world. I mean, there's for those of your listeners who have never heard of it, they should Google the Pirate Party in Germany, where they've captured 8-9% of the parliament through a grassroots effort with no clear party structure and no clear leader. The Chilean protests in by students, another example of grassroots organizing. People around the world are clamoring for a new governance system that allows authentic participation by citizens in a connected age. So it's not going to happen without government, but if we leave it in the hands of government alone, it's not going to happen either, because governments are not prone to give up power.
Well, let me ask you, Daniel, about the four screens to victory. I mean, this is something that that Google has put together.
Yeah, so the Four Screens to Victory campaign deals with the fact that these days we've got television, we've got our computer, our laptop, we've got our tablet device, and then we've got our mobile phones. And so, you know, for campaigns to sort of target people through each of those different screens, reach out to them through different messages and ad campaigns, you know, that's really where, you know, I think that this is all headed. I mean, we do sort of consume information through all of them, and we're increasingly seeing that people do them at the same time. And so it's not just that this is a sort of a linear experience, it's that I forget, there was a Pew study that just came out that talked about the number of people. I'm going to misquote it, so I'm not going to say, but it was a large percentage of people who sit in front of the television and have a laptop or a tablet or a phone.
You're looking
or something
at one.
Right. There's no more just kind of zoning out. You know, you're sort of constantly engaged with all this stuff. So, I mean, I think that speaks to how people are consuming all of this information.
And Andrew, even going, this feels like ancient history because you worked with the Dean campaign back in 2004. So that was 8 years ago. Just how dramatically different do you think campaigning is when you think of digital?
Oh, it's so different. I mean, when Howard was running in 2003, you know, we didn't have YouTube, we didn't have Facebook, Twitter, Google Plus, and we didn't have the broadband distribution or the Android phones or the iPads that we have today. So you know, it seems like ancient history. Really, the Dean campaign, but some of the fundamental principles remain, which was that Howard Dean was able, through technology, to build a grassroots movement, mostly through blogs, mm-hmm. a sense of community, and raise a significant amount of money online that propelled his campaign. That alone didn't get him elected. There's a whole bunch of other factors about him, about the timing, and other structural issues that are important to winning a campaign. But Howard Dean definitely was sort of the ring through the bull's nose of the political system, dragging people to understand that technology was going to play a much, or internet, online technology, interacting with citizens, many of whom have the tools themselves, was going to change politics going forward.
And perhaps the internet hobbled his campaign, I would argue, because of that one moment that got shared so easily by people, and you know, there's always that downside that a scandal or a controversy or anything that a politician does, a misstep, can appear in everybody's screen within minutes.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to talk with both of you. Daniel Seberg, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. And he's the spokesperson with the Google Politics and Elections team. Andrew Risché, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much. Really pleasure being with you both.
Pleasure to have you both here. And Andrew is the founder of Personal Democracy Forum, co-founder of Tech President, and they will be part of a panel tonight across the street at the National Constitution Center called Social Media, the New Political Battleground. It begins at 6:30. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.